Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Japanese Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm John Traphagen, your host for this podcast and a professor of anthropology in the Department of Religious Studies and the Program in Human Dimensions of Organizations at the University of Texas at Austin. Today, I am delighted to welcome Professor Suzanne Kleene to talk about her recent book, Urban Migrants in Rural Japan, which was published by the State University of New York Press in 2021. Professor Kleene, thank you for joining me on the Japanese Studies channel.
Thank you, John, for the great opportunity. I'm very excited.
Great. And I should tell our listeners that Suzanne and I have known each other for quite a long time, so we will go on a first name basis here, I think, which is good. We should begin with a little bit of background. Suzanne is a cultural anthropologist and associate professor in modern Japanese studies at Hokkaido University in Sapporo, Japan. She's published widely on rural Japan, many articles, all kinds of different things, and she's investigated a variety of practices ranging from the transmission of traditions through local festivals to rural revitalization programs and tourism to alternate lifestyles in rural areas. Her work is comprehensive, and she's made significant contributions to the study of rural Japan. Her work is widely cited and is some of the most important contemporary work going on related to rural Japan. So I'd like to begin. For one thing, I know that you're originally from Vienna. So how does someone from Vienna get interested in studying life in rural Japan, and what motivated you to write this book?
Thank you. Great. Yes, I'm Austrian originally, but I also have Japanese heritage. My mother's Japanese, and I spent a lot of my summer holidays in Japan from age two. So Japan has always been a kind of second home to me, mostly the Kanto area. But also actually looking at my family roots, they're originally from Yamagata. So they also actually left Yamagata for a better life in the Kanto area. So I guess looking at my family roots, there's also this kind of dilemma between urban and rural linkages in a way in my family history, which may have shaped my research interest in retrospect. So I guess, my connection with Japan is maybe a little bit different from conventional researchers. But it means, I guess, that Japan has always been a part of my life at a personal level, but also at other levels. So this may be a reason why I approach Japan in a kind of translocal way as well, transnational way.
So the book, you know, dealing with urban migrants, and of course there's been, you know, a fair amount of interest in people moving around inside Japan, and you know, why did you decide to pursue this as an area of study?
Yeah, I guess it kind of emerged from previous research. I was doing research into contemporary art festivals like the Echigo Tsumari Art Triennale in Niigata. And this was a kind of starting point for me to get in touch with locals in an agricultural area and see their perceptions and reactions to the art crowd, if you like, and also the tensions that emerged from this from people coming from very different worlds coming together and being involved in collaborative activities. So that was fascinating to me, and I really wanted to get more into that. And then when I was working in Okinoshima Island in Shimane Prefecture, trying to examine local festivities, like bullfighting and such practices, mm-hmm. I ran into the occasional livestock migrant who had relocated from Tokyo or other urban areas. And it was just, it seemed a very interesting thing to do and to research. So one thing kind of led to another in a way, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's often how it goes with ethnographic research. You so many questions come up in the field, and then there are new projects that just sort of emerge from the one you happen to be on. And I was interested in the introduction. You know, you're talking about the main argument of the book, and you make what I think is one of the key points of the book. You talk about the representation of the rural in contemporary Japan as having become quite fuzzy. And, you know, it's no longer that the rural is just rice paddies and traditional values, as if it ever really was entirely that. But could you, you know, talk about this fuzziness, talk about what has happened and what the sort of nature and meaning of rurality is in contemporary Japan?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Thank you. And I also remember that when you gave a talk at Hokkaido University a few years ago, you started with a great, very thought-provoking pictures of what the countryside actually is supposed mm-hmm. to look like. And I think we all have very different understandings of what countryside is. Just coming to Hokkaido, I realized when I was discussing this with a colleague that the understanding of countryside I have and he has is totally different. So I think the kind of subjectivity of interpretation is something that should be kept in mind. And, mm-hmm. and this really kind of leads us to the question of the construction of the countryside. I think there may be a huge gap between representation in media, like this kind of othering of the countryside as the rural ideal where people can get some yashi and start a new life. And actually the real experiences of people who have moved to rural areas and who find it quite exhausting on the one hand, but of course also very refreshing on the other. So the kind of idea of the slow life is really nowhere to be found, I think. Most people are extremely busy, have to get up quite early in the morning, have to do several jobs because there's not so much choice. Mm-hmm. I think the kind of real life, the real practices are quite different from the kind of representations in lifestyle magazines and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is very interesting to think about the way we imagine the rural, and of course the rural is imagined in particular ways in Japan. And actually, you mentioned my coming up there to give a talk, and I still remember flying in and looking out over Hokkaido and thinking that doesn't look like Japan. It looks like the American Midwest. It's instead of small patches of rice paddies, it's these expansive farms, and a lot of cases they're not growing rice, they're growing other things. And it struck me how different the rural is, even as a physical space, in Hokkaido as opposed to Honshu right next door.
Yeah, totally. So last time when I started my follow-up fieldwork in May and June in Tokushima, the kind of understanding experience of space really struck me, because having lived in Hokkaido for some 8 years now, I think this really has also shaped my sense of space. Living in a space that is kind of isolated, well isolated in the winter, and there's no insects crawling around, that kind of stuff, made me really kind of get a sense of insecurity when I was doing fieldwork in Tokushima. I was first worried very much about coronavirus and such, but it turns out that the real day-to-day issues were really like how to cope and survive centipedes crawling on the tatami mats and the like. So it turned out very different from what I had actually expected. And that was also quite interesting.
Yeah, that's a wonderful element of field work, is that somehow whenever you go into the field, things just do not turn out like you thought they were going to turn out, and which is good. That means we're learning things. You know, that's the what's supposed to happen. But it always intrigues me how surprised I am if I go to the field. And, so you discuss something interesting. You discuss the precarious nature of the neoliberal project, and the way this affects some people who leave urban areas for the rural. And you also do something interesting. You situate your work clearly in the aftermath of the triple disaster of 3/11. And I think this is very important because, you know, I mean, both of us do our field work in the same general part of Japan, and the effects of 3/11 on people were profound. They were, you know, not just in terms of material loss and that sort of thing, but psychologically, it really affected what people were thinking about. What am I doing here? And I've heard, you know, many people in the Tohoku region talk about, you know, 3/11 forcing them to reconsider their values and their interests, what they want to do in the future. So I was wondering if you could talk about this in relation to the, you know, urbanites who decide to move out to rural areas that you spoke with. And, how do you think, you know, 3/11 might have played a role in this, and also in their questioning the neoliberal project in Japan?
Yes, definitely 3/11 was a huge kind of paradigm shift for people. A lot of people kind of waking up from their routines and thinking that now is the time to kind of change something. And I think the Lehman shock was also another kind of turning point. And I think we've seen another third turning point with the corona crisis now. Looking at the numbers also, there's more and more people actually leaving Tokyo, moving to other areas, rural areas, but also keeping their jobs at the same time in Tokyo. So I think the corona crisis really also has reinforced a lot of the things that were already starting before. This kind of reassessment of place of work, reassessment of working style, and also reassessment of values altogether. Materialism, kind of nuclear families, all these kinds of standard life trajectories, if you like, have been reexamined and re-questioned. And a lot of people have been using these kinds of turning points to really change their place of living, and also change the entire setup, I guess, if you can say so. So I think real change is happening right now, because for the first time, looking at the statistics published by a Japanese internal ministry, it's obvious that more people are actually leaving Tokyo than coming in. So this is a big thing in terms
of... That's a big change.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also the fact that you've got the rural depopulation going on. So you have a lot of open space and empty buildings. You know, I think it's difficult to convey the number of empty abodes there are in Japan right now. But in rural areas, I mean, there are just, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of buildings that can be purchased very cheaply. And that's an attraction too, I would imagine. You know, people are having this moment where they're thinking about, what am I doing? And one thing they can do is move out to the countryside and get a house cheaply and live pretty cheaply too.
Yeah, sure. The living costs are one thing. And also, I think there's more and more opportunities available, like financial incentives, programs that offer people kind of first steps to relocate. Plus, I think there's a general understanding of local moves as being not weird as compared to maybe 10 years ago. So even on the Asadora, I was watching Asadora like yesterday. They were talking about people in the countryside who came back from Tokyo after kind of living there for a while. So this is really becoming a standard pattern, if you like, and Some of the older migrants have actually also made some derogatory remarks about people recently moving in, being kind of more mainstream and not really having a vision, but just following the kind of herd in a way. So mm-hmm. I think there's also new generations of migrants coming up now, lifestyle migrants.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting too. And then, you know, having these older migrants or maybe return migrants who, you know, move back after spending years in the city, looking down upon the new ones coming in. That's kind of an interesting phenomenon. It's a lot of things to think about. You know, there's so much going on in terms of kind of the reconstruction of identity that's happening along with this as people are thinking about who am I and, you know, what am I doing? And they're interacting with people who've already moved and, of course, the people who are already there as well. And so you discuss, you know, one of the things you discuss is there's a kind of growing convergence of work and leisure activities for some of the migrants that you worked with. And, you know, Japan, of course, is a society that has always had the image of putting a big emphasis on work over leisure. People work very long hours and don't have much leisure time. And I'm curious if you think attitudes towards work-life balance, you know, how are they constructed among some of the people that you've worked with? And do you think the people you talked with are at the cutting edge of what might be a major shift in Japanese society when it comes to values related to work and life balance, or something else going on? I'm curious what you think about that.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, I know. That's a tough question. Yeah.
I'm very much tempted to go along with Bill Kelly, who was saying that it's actually not our task to make any prognosis,
right?
Because there's so many elements we can't really foresee. But generally, I just remembering all the people I talked to, and also drawing on the people I talked to my recent fieldwork. I think everyone is working a lot. Yeah. And is especially there's also gendered divide, I guess, with especially males very much identifying themselves through work and successful work, and successful work usually being understood as involving some sort of self-sacrifice. So mm-hmm. there's a yep. kind of understanding that long working hours are a virtue in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think in that sense, not so much has changed since the Showa period, even for people who are quite young. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, people I've talked to recently who have moved overseas are much more radical in reshaping their lifestyles, their work styles. I was talking to a person working in IT, mm-hmm. and he was saying he's only working 3 hours a day. That's his perfect understanding of work-life balance. The rest, he wants to support his family, cook, do some mm-hmm. domestic work, help his wife. So I think maybe the kind of radical reshapers of work and life balance are more found in the kind of diaspora, if you like, mm-hmm. rather than in the domestic migration. So. I wouldn't say that there have been too many people from my own experience within Japan who have managed to carve out radically new work styles. It was more yeah. about the vision, trying to make the vision happen and trying mm-hmm. to kind of sacrifice your well-being on the way to that. And kind of something I also wrote about in the book, this kind of idea that someday people will achieve what they have in their minds, but until then they have to persevere and work long hours.
Yeah, that's certainly been my experience, you know, working with small business startups in rural Japan, and the length of the hours they put in every day are just incredible. I mean, you know, getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning after having gone to bed at 11 o'clock at night on a daily basis, because, you know, it's their business. And so they have to keep the work going, and there's a lot of work to do. And so, yeah, that's been my experience too. I find it quite interesting because I have had people tell me well, I moved to rural Japan because I wanted the slow pace of life. And nothing they're doing suggests they have anything like a slow pace of life. They just work and work and work all the time. So you know, one of the things that I think really intrigues me about this, the question of migrants moving around in Japan is kind of the issue of newcomers. The village I worked back in the 90s, I still remember very well that there were the people that had been there for a long time and there were the newcomers who had arrived about 150 years ago, and they were still perceived as newcomers. And as I read your book, I was thinking, you know, back to Jennifer Robertson's very good book, Natives and Newcomers, where she talks about this kind of question and the difficulties that newcomers have in adjusting to and being accepted in these communities when they move to another part of Japan. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the experiences that the migrants, newcomers had in Ishinomaki and, you know, the places that you've been doing your work. Maybe you have some anecdotes or two that might help the audience understand what the relationship is between natives and newcomers, insiders and outsiders in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Wonderful questions and issues. I guess it depends a lot on which places and regions you're talking about, and also the history of these places. For example, Tokushima Prefecture, Kamiyama Town, has been part of the pilgrimage path. So they've had a long history of coming and going. Often people who are not necessarily committed to the place long term, but they're just one passing through. So I think locals are quite friendly in accepting visitors and settlers. While in other places, which may be more mountainous, secluded, people may be quite may take more time to accept newcomers. So I think the geographical location also plays a huge role in how locals deal with new settlers. Another thing may also be the origin of settlers themselves, something that people may not be aware of so much. Actually, one newcomer was sharing this with me recently, saying that she arrived at the same time with another settler. They're both kind of similar age, both women, and she herself is from Tokyo, and the other person is from Kyushu, and the whole and this is happening in Tokushima. And they were both kind of trying to get to know locals and engage as much as they can, both being very social and also being good friends. And at some point, she really was wondering why her friend from Kyushu was seeming so much more successful with the local old person, old guys. And it kind of boiled down to her, to the language, to the accent, because she had the Tokyo accent, which people in Tokushima apparently, as the kind of standard language, have a little bit of a sense of distance to, while a friend from Kumamoto, still being quite different types of accent, but still being kind of part of Western Japan, which gave the locals apparently some sense of closeness. So in many cases, these kind of things also play a role and may need to be considered.
Yeah, the presence of dialects is something that I think is difficult to underestimate the importance of that in Japan. As you go around to different parts of Japan, it is striking how different the local dialects are. And I actually still remember years ago, my wife and I went on a driving trip. You know, my wife is Japanese. We got lost. And we were just in the neighboring prefecture from where she grew up. And she got out to get directions. It was taking her the longest time. She finally comes back. And I said, wow, what took so long? She says, oh, I couldn't understand anything you said.
Yeah.
And it's this intense dialect difference just across two prefectures. And you know, I remember when I got the first time I got to my field site and I started talking, particularly older people have this, you know, the dialect from the area. And for a moment, I wonder if maybe I had just studied the wrong language in graduate school, because I couldn't understand a word. I mean, nothing.
Yeah.
And that really is interesting when you think about, you know, these people now, these younger people moving around or middle-aged people moving around, and they can't easily communicate with the locals if they don't understand the dialect. And I think that's going to become less and less of a problem because standard Japanese is more, you know, typical everywhere now. But when it comes to talking to older generations, they still often have a very, very thick dialect. Mm. Yeah, that's a very interesting observation.
Another thing may also be the sense of time and how fast people should be doing special things. So just having a chat with a neighbor, you know, some people in Hokkaido may have a different sense of how long this should be taking as compared to people in Tokushima or other places. So I think this kind of small talk, which a lot of us urban people might think, what is this for? It's just a waste of time. Mm-hmm. It's not content related. For other people, it may be very important. So I guess this kind of social chit-chat is quite has high priority in some places.
Yeah, and along with that, also just dropping in. So, you know, urban people tend to want to schedule when they're going to get together. But in rural Japan, you just show up at your neighbor's door and open the door and stick your head in and say, hi, I'm here, entertain me.
Yeah,
and they
totally.
Do. That's what happens, you know. and you know, someone might sit and have tea and cakes for 3 hours or something like that. And they're very happy with that because for them, what's very important is maintaining that social connectedness. And I think it's also very tied in with a kind of a network of interdependence and mutual support that exists in rural areas that is, it's not absent in urban areas, but it's certainly not like it is in rural places. And so,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I would imagine it's an interesting experience for, you know, a 30 something Japanese to move to a rural town and just try to adjust to the flow and pace of life and the way things operate there because it's so different.
Actually, there's a very insightful video by Kochi Town, I think, about kind of newcomers and the kind of encounter between newcomers and locals communication sometimes not going so well. So at some point in the conversation, one of the two looks like an alien because, you know, it's just they're coming from different worlds and they will need time to kind of get to know each other and understand each other. And I think this video is really well made to make people understand that, you know, we're coming from totally different worlds and people need to understand that. Also to avoid this kind of people moving in and moving out again quickly. So
Yeah. If they move there, people want them to stay because they want people to come into these areas. You know, this conversation just underscores the problem with this sort of ever existing myth of Japanese homogeneity, that this is a very heterogeneous society. And you know, when you've got people who live not too far from each other, but they can't communicate because they have different dialects, that you get all of these questions of identity and, you know, self and local, you know, ways of doing things that create a fairly complex set of social interactions. And this is actually one of the things much of your work really does very nicely, is it captures that sense of Japan in general and rural Japan in particular as a complex and heterogeneous place. You know, you've studied a lot of different things to get into this. And you and I have both done work on entrepreneurial activities in rural areas. And you raise some really good examples of how the 3/11 disaster influenced entrepreneurs in Miyagi. And I noticed this up in Iwate, just to the north, that a lot of people came in to take advantage of the opportunities that existed following this. And so I'm curious, you know, how do you think the disaster operated as sort of a framework for encouraging entrepreneurialism?
Yeah, first, I think a lot of people started by doing volunteer activities, engaging in volunteer activities and getting to know the place and making local connections, which mm-hmm. was extremely important for the later entrepreneurial activities. So I think a lot of the entrepreneurs I ended up writing about in my book, I knew as volunteers because I was doing research into disaster volunteers after 2011.
Sorry, my dogs are going nuts because we're suddenly having a thunderstorm here. But let's just keep going. So
I hope the connection is okay. I can hear the dog barking.
Yes, yes.
So. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great. So so I think a lot of the people who ended up working as entrepreneurs came into Ishinomaki as disaster volunteers first. And that's the kind of ideal starting point to actually work as an entrepreneur because you get to know all the stakeholders in the community. Right. But I think local areas are also really important for female entrepreneurs. Recently, I've been observing this female single women who moved into rural areas to work as entrepreneurs and do a kind of, I guess, one woman entrepreneur kind of activity in the places they live. So they also kind of strategically use the space they have rented as a kind of normal accommodation as a shop and kind of also draw on social capital to reduce costs and reduce risk. So I was very much inspired by a female entrepreneur recently.
Sorry about the dogs. It's every time the thunder goes, the dogs go. But it'll give our listeners something interesting going on.
Yeah, they're so sensitive to sound, right? So
yes,
I feel
they
sorry
are.
For them.
Yep. Yep.
Some female entrepreneurs have really managed to get a niche and kind of make the company work just being by themselves, which I think is quite amazing.
Yeah, actually, that was something that, when I did my own work on entrepreneurs, I had initially started I had run across a lot of women who had started small business. And I was actually curious about, we've got kind of the image of the sort of patriarchal rural Japan. And you got these women going there. Well, how does that work for them? I was really, curious. And I kind of hypothesized that there were roadblocks. And I actually didn't find much in the way of that. Most of the women said, no, everybody around here has been very supportive of my interests, and they found it a very easy place to develop their businesses. And that surprised me. And did you find things like that as well in your work?
Yeah, I think maybe entrepreneurial activities are kind of a way of creating alternative employment, because in official jobs, like, let's say, the Yakuba municipal office is male dominated, so most of the women working there are only part-time workers. So the people who don't want to do this kind of job, they're going into the entrepreneurial activities and drawing on a lot of social networks, like female kind of stakeholders who are very supportive, who help them start up, find a place. And so I also, from my own experience talking to people this time, it was really quite, they're quite positive about the experience and they're quite hopeful that they might actually be able to make it work. So it's quite, I guess it resembles the experiences you describe in your book.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of similarities, and quite a few women that I spoke with, one of the things they described was exactly what you just described. The glass ceiling is very low for many of the careers that they can have, like in the city hall or something like that. But if they start their own business, they're in control of what they're doing, and they can actually do things the way they want to. And so it makes it a very appealing thing, as long as they can get, business. it works very well. But it does mean a lot of work too. You know, again, kind of back to this question of the slow pace. They don't have a slow pace. They're extremely busy. But I think women I spoke with, and men as well, also are really committed to and enjoy what they're doing. They seem to get a great deal out of it. Something that, you know, I think your book does really well, and is something that is very important to me, as, you know, someone who's worked in rural Japan for a long time, is as you work through the arguments in the book, one of the things that you really do well is you deconstruct this idea of a rural-urban divide in Japan. And we talked a little bit about this at the beginning as, you know, in a sense, one of the things that motivated this. And so I'd like you to spend a few minutes doing that. You know, what do you think some of the problems or maybe the advantages or disadvantages of thinking about Japan in terms of urban and rural frames or experience in life, or disposing of that? You know, does the divide make sense? Or is it something that, you know, we should really be doing away with? And I'm really interested to know what you think about that.
Mm-hmm. Great question. I think we could spend years discussing that.
I think you're right. Yes, and quite a bit of beer. Yeah.
So I think Japan is an extremely centralized country. Just looking at the way education has been set up, it's totally focused on urban areas. So education is also a huge problem for people who are moving to rural areas. So I think these kinds of infrastructural points being kind of heavily centralized is a huge anachronism in a way. And people have been discussing about changing it for some time, but not too much is happening. But now with COVID, of course, mm-hmm. you know, this may change and people might have more flexibility in combining two or even three places of residence at the same time. So some of the people I've been talking to were saying that they would like to actually divide their time between, let's say, Tokyo and Tokushima, also for the mm-hmm. sake of their children and for the sake of a more global outlook and, you know, all the kind of benefits that come with living in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. But they also want to, of course, enjoy the kind of positive points of rural areas. So mm-hmm. I think it's kind of trying to bring the best of all of both lifestyles together. And quite a few of the people I talked to were actually talking about having a two divided lifestyle, I guess. But maybe one other point that may be difficult is really the kind of black and white understanding of rural and urban. I think it's very fluid. It's obvious from the way people live. Just arriving from a follow-up field work this time, I was really amazed by the availability of coffee, of great mm-hmm. coffee. Before, it was always a big kind of problem of getting good coffee, like not the cold kind of American coffee. Sorry about that. The Japanese people, people call American, but like espresso or something, Italian style right. espresso. So this time, it's like you can find all these kinds of third wave coffee kind of temporary mm-hmm. shops. And of course, this may also be understood as a kind of gentrification and, mm-hmm. You know, lots of problems coming with that. But I think it's just an example of urban elements pervading rural areas. And I think generally it's a good thing because there's more choice.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, from my perspective, what's happened is that Japan has become an increasingly a cosmopolitan society as a whole. And so there are still places that are rural and urban, but as you describe it, the fluidity is just tremendous. And I've noticed this, you know, really started, I think, taking off in the 90s. I remember when certain kinds of stores came into where I was doing my field work in Iwate. And products that were not available, all of a sudden, there were these new things that were available, like peanut butter. Peanut butter had never been available in Japan, and you know, like except maybe in Tokyo, and it was even hard to find. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you had peanut butter, and you had American beers, even some unusual American beers that, you know, rather than Budweiser and Miller, and a variety of things coming from different parts of the world. And people are excited about this and they're buying it. And so you really have this kind of cosmopolitanization going on in the 90s. And what we now see some 25 years later is that the rural areas have a very cosmopolitan quality to them. They're not rural in that sort of traditional sense that they used to be thought of. And many of the people that live there have traveled all over the world. That's not unusual at all. They have the funds to do that. And so they often do. And I think that's, to me, that's actually one of the really wonderful things about this book is that you really capture that. You capture the sense of a flow of things going back and forth, that it's not a monolithic sort of place, but it's this kind of inventive place with new things going on that are drawing both on the cosmopolitan aspects of Japan, but also kind of some of the tradition, the social, the way people socially interact, it's all also there as well. So that was a really wonderful part of the book.
Thank you. I think maybe people are also trying to bring together the local features of the place, trying to work and forage local ingredients, but also kind of combining it with cosmopolitan elements. So I was really surprised by amazing desserts being available in rural places. I mean, like working, there was this pastry chef who worked with chamomile that was widely available in front of the house and using it for panna cotta. And you've also written about the gelato shop. So I think that's very kind of similar, like using local ingredients, working closely with the local community, but also having this kind of cosmopolitan touch. And I think that really makes rural areas so strong, also thinking about it in a global outlook. So.
Yeah, the gelato shop that I've studied is a great example of this because you've got gelato, which is, of course, very cosmopolitan, international. And yet the flavors, there are standard flavors like, you know, chocolate chip and this kind of thing, but there's also asparagus-flavored gelato there or tomato sorbet, all made with local ingredients and appealing to tastes of locals, things that they like and they want to have in their food. And so this kind of hybridization goes on between the local and the international in the loci of these little shops and things that are going on there. So, you know, Suzanne, this is a fantastic book. I think a lot of people need to read this book. Anyone who's interested in really in understanding rural lifestyle in general, there's a lot to get out of this. And it's a very ethnographically rich and theoretically very sophisticated book. So there's, you know, wonderful things going on in this. So is there anything that we've left out of our conversation here that you would like to convey to the listener, something that about your work that you think is important that we haven't touched on?
Yeah, maybe I would like to just go back once more to the kind of entrepreneurial activities and the kind of aims that people have, trying to kind of scale it down from a kind of mass production to a more individually kind of focused production. And I guess sustainable sort of activity. And I think this really hopeful because it means that people can experiment with various things they think makes sense to them personally. And of course, you know, it's very difficult to make it work from a kind of production point of view, but the fact that so much space is available, as we talked before, and the fact that living costs are much cheaper in rural areas makes experiments kind of easier than other places like Tokyo. So I think attempts to achieve a more sustainable lifestyle and consumption patterns is something that maybe should be mentioned. And also, generally, I think the kind of change of rural areas from the kind of places that are associated with failure, with stagnation, to places that actually offer experimental grounds for people who are kind of willing to go for an adventure, willing to, you know, to try their hands at innovation. Mm-hmm. And actually also engage with the local community. So, of course, social capital is everything right. in these places. And I think here there's also a little bit of a gender divide in the sense that mm-hmm. young women seem to be much better than, at kind of engaging with the local community mm-hmm. in general compared to the male counterparts. Especially in the kind of small scale activity. So mm-hmm. I think there may be lots of female entrepreneurs coming out from rural areas in the future, mm-hmm. especially now with COVID. You know, these kinds of female entrepreneurs who cater to very niche markets, but mm-hmm. who are working with very high-end ingredients, who need lots of time to do research and who want to really offer the best that is available in their field, literally speaking, and also in an abstract way. Mm-hmm. So I think this may really be a kind of revamping of consumption and production patterns that we have seen in Japan. And I think this really makes rural areas a kind of worth studying further for other scholars as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the things that's become very clear, your work is, you know, very strongly provides evidence of this, is that rural Japan, you know, the words to maybe use to think about it are not decline and backwards, but are innovative and experimental and inventive. There's a great deal of inventiveness going on, I think. And not just, I think it's entrepreneurs, of course, are part of it, but also local municipalities are trying to find new ways to build a sustainable environment so that people can stay there, so that they want to stay there, or they can move there. You just see a great deal of creativity, in my view, going on in rural parts of Japan right now, which is, I think, really fascinating. And as you say, really demands more research in these areas because it's happening before our eyes. And that makes it, I think, a really interesting opportunity. So that brings me to my last question. What's up next? Can you tell our listeners about what research you're currently working on, what projects maybe you have in mind?
Okay, yeah, great. So I've started a new project last year, but because of COVID, it was difficult because, ironically, the topic is transnational mobilities.
Mm-hmm. So yes, that's the worst possible time to pick that topic, isn't it?
I know. So I got a grant in 2020, and uh-huh. of course I've been busy buying books.
Right. Yes.
But there is a limit to what you can do with books. So I've started kind of online ethnography, and I was quite skeptical in the beginning because, you know, it's so different from being in the field meeting people and smelling all the plants and all that.
Yep.
But I've been mostly actually interviewing people in the IT industry. So people who have left Japan and work and live in Europe mostly. Mm-hmm. And I've had very positive experiences with this kind of new, I guess, digital ethnography. Mm. I've also been using Clubhouse, so these kind of chat rooms mm-hmm. for kind of Japanese overseas communities, kind of trying to exchange their ideas and experiences, which I also think is fascinating, like being limited to an acoustic environment rather than having the visual sense and also visceral sense that comes with fieldwork. It's quite interesting as a feedback.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's very interesting because it does challenge the sort of the way in which we think about and construct what we do as ethnographers. You know, when you don't have the smells and you don't have that visceral quality things, it's a very different way of connecting with the people. But also it's important because that's the way a lot of people are connecting these days, that the context has changed for many people to these kinds of virtual contexts that don't carry that aspect of experience with them. Those parts of our senses are not used in those contexts, which I think also makes for some pretty interesting questions about doing ethnography from a methodological perspective.
Yeah, totally. So it's basically a continuation of my previous research, kind of focusing more on the transnational features of people who have left Japan and kind of trying to understand what they appreciate about living abroad and how they actually see Japan from overseas, which is extremely insightful in terms of gender, work, work-life balance. A lot of people criticizing the lack of diversity in Japan and that being a feature of a kind of drive for them to leave Japan. So I've been doing this recently, and I hope I can actually go to Europe at some point.
Yeah, that's, you know, an interesting thing comes up with that, too, the extent to which the context the person overseas is living in. So over the past 5 years, my wife's attitude about returning to Japan became much more, I want to go back to Japan, because the political climate in the U.S. has just been so antithetical to people from other countries. And, you know, it's like the construction of what Japan is, and I'm sure of any country that, you know, where you have expatriates looking back, changes in relation to the context that you're living in. And you know, that's, I think that's really a kind of an intriguing way to think about this, is that, you know, how is the experience of where I am affecting my thinking about that place from which I came? So this sounds like it's going to be a really interesting study.
I can't wait till you write it up. Thank you. I can't wait to read your new novel.
Well, I'll send you a copy. That was an interesting aside. It's was diving into experimental ethnography, and I'm actually going to be doing an interview with someone, being the interviewee on this on the New Books Network next week. So that'll be interesting. But I'll send you a copy.
Great.
So I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join me on the Japanese Studies channel on the New Books Network. Urban Migrants in Rural Japan is a major contribution to the study of the changing features of Japanese society, not just rural society, but the society as a whole. As people go through the process of thinking about their own experiences of life and continually reassessing their values. I mean, this is what 311 did and other things, you know, the COVID is doing. And I think your work points out very clearly that in order to understand Japan or any society, we have to be very attuned to the reality of ongoing change. You know, societies are moving targets. You never get the way it is. You get the way it was sort of briefly, but it's always changing. And this is a really significant book that captures that. And I think it'll be very helpful for people interested in rural studies, as well as migration studies and work on the conceptualization of urban and rural worlds. So thank you again very much for joining me.
Thank you.